This is one of the old stock answers, now that I think of it. The Al-Anon, they say to the drunk, where you been? Nowhere. Now, we know it's not possible for him to be nowhere. What have you been doing? Nothing. You've been drinking. Two beers. Leave the bar in this semi-stratospheric state, and I wander down Main Street of Roseville to my wife's sister's home, at which place I was residing. And I went in and lay down upon the bed, and any other time, I would have been asleep. Any other time, you would have been asleep. But this particular day, I was either coming or going, and I wasn't asleep. And this is the conversation that went on in the next room. My wife, in hysteria, cried out to her sister, and she said, what on earth would you do if you were living with a man like that? And her sister didn't hesitate a moment. She said, well, I'd poison the son of a bitch. I was too poor to hire a food taster. But believe you me, from then on, they ate first. I think psychiatry would call this a state of paranoia. Our book calls it the state of absolutely no defense. That little feeling you were talking about. And I don't think that there's anybody as uncomfortable as a drunk. As uncomfortable as a drunk. I think this is the greatest thing that we get from this society, is the ability to sit down and be peaceful with one another. I stayed sober through a subconscious envy because my sponsor didn't jump. Not from what he said. From the feeling we experience in AA. We were sitting last night picking Doc's head for some of the treasures that come out of our society and what happened here and what happened there. And I said to him, if you could say one thing, what would you tell me that turned the light bulb on with you when you came to AA? And he said, I'd have to give it a little thought. And he slept on it last night, and he came to me today, and he said it was the thing, the feeling that I had when I came to AA. The feeling that I had when I came to AA. And I think this is about the secret of it all. Well, I got down. It has been rumored around that I drank a little wine. I'll get this over with right quick. I did it for medicinal purposes, I can assure you. People make fun of the winos, but wine does have some wonderful medicinal qualities. It will absolutely cure hay fever. If you drink it like I did, you don't dare sneeze. father laughing at that over there. This gets you pretty close to home. Yes, sir. But I remember how ashamed I was and how small I felt, even smaller so than I had prior to this. And this was the beginning of the landslide, I guess, and I got out. Got out in the hotel room in Sacramento. I don't know how long it lasted, and I would not be dramatic in trying to tell some of you drunks about what happens to you. I had a little hallucination and a little more stuff that we come to learn how to live with after a fashion in AA, but it's not interesting to a lot of non-alcoholics. I don't know how long it lasted, but I got up and staggered out of this hotel, and I went home to Mary, and I cried out to her, and I think she could see that something hellish had happened. I think she could see that something had changed there, really, and I really was desperate. And I said to her, I'm sick. This was the first time I'd ever admitted it. I never had been sick in my life except this throwing up sick that you do in the morning. Hell, I thought everybody threw up every morning. I didn't. I used to rent a hotel room with twin beds in it, one to sleep in, one to throw up in. Just as simple as that. We didn't have a doctor, and it was against the rules of this company, you know, to admit that you were drinking. And we had to call this little railroad physician, and he came down to, and he was a little feller. I can imagine how he felt. And here come the Al-Anons again. He said to my wife, "Does he drink?" I don't think she fooled him very much, but I was in a terrific physical condition, and he gave me a shot of some of the happy medicine in my arm and gave her a prescription of some of the most delightful pills that I later learned to like real well. Phenobarbital, I believe they were, 1 gram phenobarbital. And he said to her, "This man's sick and he needs to be in a hospital." And he wasn't breaking any news to me. I was real sick, but I didn't still know with what. So they loaded me in the ambulance and we went from Sacramento to San Francisco, 90 miles an hour with the red light on, the siren screaming, and I'm up in the back eating them pills. And I've always looked back on this trip with a feeling of irony. Here's a guy that's been drunk 18 years in there in a hell of a hurry to do something about it. This is the non-alcoholic application, you know, right now. And when I got to the hospital, it was a day and a half before I saw a doctor. I guess they were out testing cigarettes or breaking the laxative habit or something. And science has made some great strides recently that the outside public is forced on. And they put me through one of the most stringent clinics in the West Coast, from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, and it's not a lot of fun with a hangover. I learned that you shouldn't ever go to a proctologist with a hangover. And the result of the examination was that I had nothing organically wrong with me. And this was a disappointment to everybody. Nothing organically wrong with me. The hospital works on the theory that its inmates, or not inmates, patients, have got to have something wrong with them. They couldn't say I was just there resting. And this was my introduction to psychiatry. And left to make an humble observation, very humble observation, that all the alcoholics that I know in AA who have been cured of their alcoholism by having it beaten out of them through their knees with a rubber mallet are very few. But piano. And he would beat my knees and ask me questions. And he asked me some real stupid questions. And I gave him some brilliant answers. He's not a rummy now, it's not my fault. I remember one of the things that he asked me, did you ever suck your thumb? And I remember how he quivered when I told him, yes, I still do. Run over in the corner and take a quick pull at it. I'll tell you folks how to get rid of a psychiatrist. You let two drunks lay up in bed one night and memorize the same dream to tell him. Lord, I'm glad to find that out. Kind of like the old barroom spittoon. If you don't get the proper aim on them, you can make a hell of a mess out of it. But he prescribed another delightful little dose that some of our girls in AA are quite fond of. Bromide. He gave me sodium bromide elixir. And for those of you who are not pharmaceutically inclined, this is the granddaddy of Nervine. You know how the girls, Aunt Minnie, used to sit in the back room and suck on the Nervine. And you'd apologize for it and say, Aunt Minnie can't come out today. She's nervous. Well, she couldn't come out. She's gone. And it's a good ride it is. Food doesn't disturb it. Real enjoyable little dose. A few things wrong with it. Your eyes will cross and you'll froth at the mouth a little. But other than that, it's a great thing. So I was drinking bromide, stealing pills, and we had a Mexican running up and down the elevator shaft bringing us wine. This was the therapy that I got in the hospital. And I know I got to tell this on the psychiatrist, and this is a true story, so help me. I had one psychiatrist who had a fetish about folks chewing their fingernails. He thought this meant something. And every morning he would come through the ward and put me through the indignity of making me hold my hands out like that. And when he'd see that my nails were meticulously manicured, he'd go on happy, just smiling and just thrill to death, it seemed to me. But every day he looked at my fingernails. This is the same psychiatrist who had 3 months prior to that time pulled out all of my teeth. And I don't know how in the hell he thought I could chew my fingernail. That's a bar of yours. And from that day until the day I got to AA, I never did bother about getting any teeth. I didn't need them. If you're on a fluid diet, that's all you need. I could, to where I could crack a hickory nut without them. How does a drunk feel? He thinks that his alcoholic life is the only normal one. He cannot tell the true from the false. You should remember that the next time the guy comes to the door. Well, they ran me off from the hospital and I went to Sacramento and got home. I had my cake and I could eat it. I could go to the bar and tell them about being sick and mooch a few drinks. And finally, I even got double-crossed by a bartender. He called my wife and one day and he said, "Mrs. Leith, you think your husband's sick. But when you go to work in the morning, he gets up and comes down here. And then he runs home at 11:30 and lets you prepare his meal for him and feed him. And then when you leave, he gets up and comes back down here." And he further added, "We don't want him." This upset my wife. She had set great store by the treatment that that the hospital had given me. She called this skull jockey down in San Francisco there. And I don't know what he told her, but this was when she left. And I can say that without any rancor in my heart whatsoever, because I think that you and me, being subjected to the phenomenon of craving, as it is described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, will cling to any crutch at hand to perpetuate this disease. We'll cling to any crutch at hand. The absence of my wife was only the absence of another crutch. And I went back to the hospital again. 3 months more, new psychiatrist, the old one wouldn't come to see me. Can you imagine that? And they brought a little fella in from Berkeley out there, and he looked like one. He had the long Van Dyke beard and the shell glasses, and he couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak what he spoke. I remember one of the questions that he got through to me, though. He said, "Did you ever wet the bed?" And that bothered me, because I know that's a result of drinking and not the cause of it. He used to say, "Put the potted plants in the garage. We're going to have a party tonight and Joe's coming." I've killed more potted plants than bad weather. Finally, they threw me out again. The little resident physician came to my nervous ward. This was before the days when we had the facilities that alcoholics have now. In those days, they didn't believe in depriving the alcoholic of his right to suffer. We hadn't been given the ability to develop ourselves into institutional bums in those days. And they were not going to admit that they had an alcoholic in this hospital. I was a man who had responsibility for 400 or 500 lives every time I took a train out. And they certainly were not going to say, well, we've got a drunk in here. So I was in the nervous ward. But they came and threw me out. And I knew I was in for the winter. Just knew it. And this fellow had heard all of my tale of woe, and he finally came to me and he said, you're going to have to go. Let some sick people come in here. And then he said, where are your people? And I said, well, they're down in Texas. And I think his eyes lit up. And he said, go down there by all means. Keep him moving. Keep him moving. And I went to Texas and found a little small town psychiatrist down there. And he loved to talk. And I would go and let him talk. And he would give me goofballs with a popcorn sack full. We had a lot of enjoyable seances together. Two great minds at work there. Until one morning I awoke from this peaceful slumber induced by Pina Bobdoff to look up and find two deputy sheriffs looking down at me. And they said, get up and come go with us. I remember this very vividly. My mother had blown the whistle. I asked one of these deputies, I had a lot of trouble getting my shoelaces tied, and I asked him, will you help me with my shoelace? And he said, hell no, we've got plenty of time. And I found out that they did. And they took me to the county pokey. This is the smart fella, the arrogant fella, the genius, who had returned home after these many years. And I stayed up in this jail and hated every living thing, particularly my mother for having brought this great humiliation down upon me. Well, hell, it wasn't my first jail, nor was it my last, incidentally. But I remember how I seethed with this bitter hatred. And I stay there for 4 or 5 days. It's a rather nebulous thing. But one morning there came a fella to my cell. And he called for me by name. And I remember, if I should look back and describe it, I would say that it was a rather cruel procedure for a man to stand and undress you literally by telling his own story. And he came to the jail and told me all about himself. And he carried this 5-word message of Alcoholics Anonymous when he said to me, I know how you feel. This is the first time that anybody had ever said that. Oh, I'd been subjected to all of the cliches that we've laughed about before. But this is the first time that anyone had ever said this. And I listened a little bit. And the greatest miracle of all is that he came unsolicited. You're looking at a man who is sober today. because he hadn't listened to some of the fat cat talk in an AA club, which goes like this: if he wants it, let him come get it. And I'm not smart enough yet to know what motivated him into making this trip, but thank God he did. And he came to see me unsolicited and told me all about himself. This was my message of AA. And do you know, I reared back and turned him away. He put the hex on me. And I would say to you that when you go, don't go for him, go for yourself. Who said it? And I'm assured that if you had asked the man when he left the jail that day, did you do any good, he would have said no. The smart aleck, he's too arrogant. He might have even come up with this great profound thing that you hear so often now. He ain't ready for AA. Oh. Oh. But before he left, and the thing I think that fascinated me about him was that I couldn't make him react. Everybody that I'd ever dealt with, I could cut them and knife them and get a reaction, but not this cat. He stood there and didn't jump a bit. And his serenity was evidenced in what I saw. What you see is what you get. Well, my people are just like all other non-alcoholics. They're a little bit, well, ain't they? My mother said to him, "Is he all right now?" And he said, "No, I just don't know what to tell you about it." He didn't agree for anything. And being the wise woman that she was, she said, "Well, what'll we do? If we let him out, he'll get drunk." And do you know, he came up with a profound statement that is somewhere in our book of experience. He said, "Yes, he will get drunk. His condition demands it." So they arranged. No, that's not the word for it. They didn't. They paid two deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car, sent my bags down to the jail, and they carried me 200 miles to Houston, Texas, to put me on a train that went west. Keep him moving. And I think when we sit in AA and chop our gums about our disease and how we rise above it, that sometimes we may put a great emphasis upon the physical suffering of alcoholism. Do you know, I don't remember as much of it as I thought it did, but you know what I remember? I remember the humilities and the indignities of this feeling that our book describes as having absolutely no defense. And as we sat in that immense station in Houston with these two fuzzies on either side of me that day, and I weighed 119 pounds, didn't have any teeth, had a pair of pants on, any of you could have got in with me. Don't tell me that I didn't suffer. I remember it if I live to be 1,000. This is the freedom that I got when I came to the portals of AA. I've never felt ashamed since I made my first trip up those stairs. Well, I went back to California, and this is a rather sordid story, and I'll cut it out. Time's gone. But somewhere in this flop house that I had ended up in on the riverbank in Sacramento, one night I cried out to myself, I guess. Nothing dramatic about an experience like that, because the old drunk, like I said, does it all alone. No audience to enjoy these things. And I think this is the greatest thing about an experience in AA. I don't know what I said to myself, but something maybe like this, that I've got something wrong with me that I can't fix myself. I've got to go outside to get some help. And I got to find that fella that came to see me in jail. And I staggered out of this place. You know, brute force and awkwardness. It's hard to come up on your feet like that. And I came back 2,600 miles to find the fella that came to see me in the jail, because I wanted to find out what made him not jump. I wanted to find out what made him stand still. I wanted to find out what made him have that look on his face that I see here in such a wide array, that's worth everything on earth to us today. So I got back to Texas and I found him. And do you know, one of the miracles of our society is the fact that we have no limit to how far we go. They don't set a date when you quit. And the fella said, "Why, yes, I'll come back again," after I'd insulted him, after I'd reprimanded him up in the jail, after I'd been snide and smart with him. He very gently said, "Yes, when will you be able to go to a meeting?" So if you ask me, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous lies greatly in the man's willingness to make the second trip. Anybody can make the first one. The second trip. So he took me to my first AA meeting. And I've had to compare every other AA meeting with this one. Shoved me up the old dirty stairs there. My God, in those days they were all upstairs, weren't they? These were dark, dingy, dirty stairs, and they were a little cut on the bias. And he took me up there this night in this maudlin state that I was in. And I don't remember any of the things that were said. Any of the little goodies that were dropped by the elder statesman in AA, I don't remember that. I remember experiencing a communication that here are some people like me. And the sickening loneliness that plagues every alcoholic as long as he sits on that stool and drinks left me that night, and thank God it has never returned. Moment of levity and a moment of seriousness, and I'll let you go home. One of the greatest things that stands in the way of an alcoholic is his ability to heal too fast. We heal too fast. This thing would leave the scars outside instead of inside. We'd do a whole lot better with it. But I got well in a hurry. And I got a call to... Oh, I just got all overboard. I knew the whole bit in 2 weeks. In fact, you might say that I became God-like. Have you ever seen any AA members who are God-like? So I get a call to pick up a drunk one night, and they had taken his jug away from him, and all he wanted was to get the jug back. And I picked him up and put him in my car with a buddy of mine, and I began to give him the pitch. Oh, God, I felt good. And as I drove slowly and his eyes began to water, and I knew I had him. And as we drove on with this great eloquence of mine, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder. And I knew I had him. Did you ever hear of anybody throwing up silently? Time I've ever gotten godlike where the drunk he pukes on me. And I don't know what the time limit is for working in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked with a fella for 4.5 years. Got a call, my wife took it, went out and picked him up. He's as scurvy as I was. I borrowed a goblet of whiskey and poured it down him to keep him from having DTs. I knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshackled from this drink, he was in AA club. Any way you get him there is good to me. And he stayed sober for 3 months and he got drunk. And it was a blow to my ego. And I said to myself, he can't help but sober up under my direction. And I went and got him again. And I brought him back. And he had an affliction I know none of you ever had. He'd go to faraway places and call me Colette. to tell me that he was drunk. And I prayed about him. I said, God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to let me have this one, I'll tell you. He's more than a body can stand. But I kept on plugging away at it for 4.5 years. About 9 years ago, he got on for him what I hope was his last drunk in one of our local motels. And he called another fellow from our club who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he's been sober ever since. And I hated his guts. And I'd sit in the club and look at him and say, you ought to be mine. If I know anything of the treasure that God gives us in AA, I owe him more than he owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. I don't know. I'm not eloquent enough to tell you of the great things that come from our program of recovery. I couldn't tell you all the good things that come to us in AA. We evidence that by sitting here tonight. The pie is in the eating. We're here. This is it. And I'll tell you a little story that happened for maybe some of those who don't quite see our book, but maybe who could see another. And then I'll go. This is a story that happened 2,000 years ago. Not unlike one of us going to see a sick feller, very similar in its circumstance. But this is a story that appears in the scripture, the story of the demoniac. You clergy fellas, keep me straight here, will you? Now, they called him a demoniac because he was a maniac full of demons, like you and me. And it says in there verbatim that he was so wild that no man could tame him. Kind of like me. And it said that the manifestations of his disease were such that they had to keep him in fetters and chains. Kind of like me. And he finally got so bad that they had to run him out of town, out on the riverbank with the pig, kind of like me. And it seems that at that time, there was a little carpenter fella going to and fro teaching a new philosophy of love. And he had a facility that you and I have not quite acquired. He could see no ill in anyone. So he says to this cat on the riverbank, "Are you having a little trouble?" And I can see the self-pity that's evidenced in the demoniac. And he said to the little carpenter, "Trouble is my name. They call me Legion, which means many." He was eat up with self-pity. The little carpenter, who could see no ill in anyone, saw that he needed some help, and he was willing to give it for the asking. And he went through a queer procedure of cleansing the demoniac, so misunderstood in those days as much as maybe our treatment is today. It had to do with the dispensing of some spirits from the demoniac into some pigs and so forth and so on. Those of you remember it, I'm sure. And the pigs ran off into the sea. And there were some stool pigeons around. And they went into the city and told the folks that owned these pigs, they said, "You're out of the pig business." And the Bible says that they rushed out in mass to see what was going on out there. They'd heard this strange story. And these are the most beautiful lines that I've ever read. It said, when they got there, he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. We've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous that reads, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. And these folks who came out, who had just been put out of the pig business, said they prevailed upon them to leave. And I can see the little fellow that had been recently healed. He had come from one life and not experienced the good of another. Like me the first night I came. And he was frightened and he didn't know what the answer was to some of these questions. They kept prevailing upon him to leave, and he said to the little carpenter, "Would you take me with you?" And the little carpenter broke a rule for one of us. Everybody that he'd ever helped up until that time, he had told them, "Go on now and don't say anything about it. You're all right now, and we've had this experience. Don't say a word about it." But he said to the poor sick guy an admonishment that I would give to you. He said, "No, you can't go with me." He said, "Stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you."